Hi there, Bob. What's on your mind?
Well, aside from your show, I like Iris and Mordecai, I understand, is making more prominence in the new show. I haven't heard, but I like what you're doing, Iris. Iris is summing up the communication problem we all have, and we are trying to start a revolution here. But with you, Ben, just having James McDougal play in your neighborhood is a revolution. So it's hard to determine what the parameters are of what we're looking for with you. What social change are we looking for? What, are we just trying to get rid of cash? What is the point of your part of my revolution?
Well, the thing that you do that I like is that you home in on... You make me realize that the thing that really interests me is we're using Skype to record this. We're up online with, how many million people? Anyway, there's 11 million people using this worldwide, talking to each other for free over the internet, which is absolutely amazing. And we're using this. We're not frightened of technology. We're using any technology we can get our hands on. At the same time, you bring it round to my 3.5-year-old daughter, Iris, being on the radio, and Jim McDougal, who's one of the most active bodies you could see on stage. I mean, he's quite terrifying. He reduces everything to, now you're here, and he might headbutt you, and you're terrified, and he sings. And it just interests me. You see, I like talking to you because you home in on this thing which interests me, which is the complete opposite, in a way, that we have here all this amazing technology and sophistication, and it allows us to think about these things which are totally unmediated and totally real and human and universal. And everybody's always had psychotic people that they get excited with. They used to call them shamans. Everybody's always had children and babies around, and you manage to not, despite your enthusiasm with technology, your McLuhanism, or the common understanding of McLuhanism, you also have this understanding of the opposite, and I like talking to you because of that.
Yes, I keep trying to tell people McLuhanism is a very small part of myself. I know I live in the present, and I recognize inspiration, the very thing you're always polysyllabically explaining on your show. You know, you quote, well, you just talk in, I don't know if it's Cambridge that did this to you, and I was thinking last night.
No, Bob, it's not Cambridge that did this to me. This is what the idiotic Zappa, hardcore Zappa fans say. It's not Cambridge that did this to me. It's Frank Zappa did this to me.
Yeah, but let me finish. As usual, you react too fast. I agree with what you just said, but here's the point I was making. I was thinking that the way the intellectual part of your thinking may, and I agree with a lot of what you say, and I was thinking, well, maybe it's because I was influenced by McLuhan, who's a Cambridge product. And, you know, I was just thinking about what went on in Cambridge, because they were apparently not Oxfordian. They were different from Oxford. You know, I.A. Richards and these guys, and Leavis. So I was just thinking to myself, was there a Cambridge alliance there? Cambridge sensibility. Now, I'm not saying you're Cambridge or anything. I'm just saying that's a thought I had, you know, that... it's like maybe the Oxford is the geniuses and Cambridge is the sub-geniuses, you know? The Oxford is Kurt Cobain and Cambridge is the Jim McDougal. I don't know what it is for those two universities in British culture. I understood from what I heard in Toronto that there was a division between the two. Is there a different sensibility, or is that all irrelevant, and that might have been true 80 years ago?
Yeah, at Oxford they're the geniuses. At Cambridge they're the plodders through the archive. And
that's what you are. That is definitely what you are, and I could be accused of that.
And somehow less plugged into the establishment. There seems to be a quick transmission belt from success at Oxford University through to big positions in journalism and politics. In Cambridge, it's always seems to be some sort of problem, that there's a kind of arcane knowledge that needs to be curated properly. I mean, I find all this actually quite irritating, and Zappa was useful for me for kind of smashing it up in my own mind. But these are things everybody has a different opinion on.
Right. I think of what Beefheart said. He liked going to Antelope Valley School, whatever it was, Valley College, because the professors who weren't going to make it to the Ivy League colleges, who were the real professors. They end up teaching in obscure places like the school Beefheart went to. And I like that point. It sounds like Cambridge is the B team and the Ivy League is Oxford, but you're going to find the stick-in-the-muds or the cranks over at Cambridge, like Beefheart found in Mojave Valley, wherever that Antelope College was that he went to. Do you know that quote?
Yeah.
Okay, so... anyways, and probably has nothing to do with Cambridge, but what
if we see, get you, off get
you
if,
understand you understand you see you have you 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 quote the new Prynne book and all that, and then you go into great music, which for me redeems you, and the and then you go into some bad music, irritating music, and then you put Iris back on, and then you rant about some Pomo critic. I mean, this is very good work, Ben. It is a revolutionary thing you're doing, but are we looking for anybody else to get on our frequency?
Absolutely, and it's my desire to do that that means I'm having these dialogues with you. By the way, Bob, it's extremely nice to hear you being nice about my radio programs on this radio program, but I keep feeling it must be slightly irritating to the listener because they're not listening to my other program, so hearing us discuss that program must be slightly annoying.
Well, that's part of us being difficult to be aligned with and get on a frequency. Everything we talk about, no one knows anything about. There's not one thing we talk about. McLuhan, Marx, the way you do it, Zappa, Beefheart, they're not really a part of the culture anymore, or they're not something. They're obscure. Mm. Only old people like Gamma know what we're referring to. If we didn't have Gamma, we wouldn't have any reference point, probably.
But right? it was a great populist gambit for you to start juggling around differences between Oxford University and Cambridge University. I mean, they have a famous boat race in London, which everybody knows about. So differences between Oxford and Cambridge is a real populist topic. And the problem with that populist topic is in pretending you understand this great division between the two most famous knowledge edifices of the British Isles, is that it obscures what really we have in common, which is that we've both thought about early 20th century modernism. Marshall McLuhan's, one of his early publications is called Counterblast. He comes out of reading Wyndham Lewis. Wyndham Lewis, who was in opposition to James Joyce, but in creative opposition to James Joyce. These people, these disputes that happened at the early part of the 20th century, have been forgotten by most media commentators. They're absolutely forgotten. And this is one reason I had to leave The Wire, the magazine The Wire that I used to be a music journalist for, is because it has franchised the what they call the avant-garde to sell it to a new generation of people who are solvent. And none of the people editing the magazine or in control of its ideas knew anything about Wyndham Lewis and James Joyce. In other words, they knew nothing about the people who pioneered the actual avant-garde of the 20th century. And that's why I think we can talk. It's not an Oxford-Cambridge thing. It's about knowing about what that explosive movement was at the beginning of the 20th century that swept away all the Victorian sentimentality and all the old rubbish and wanted to do something completely new. And we start from there and then grapple with all the things that happened afterwards. And I think that's why we can communicate.
Right, because Scott Norris, my friend who tapes my interviews, I do, we do all kinds of stuff, he's a great fan of Zappa. When I told him I was talking to you, he had heard of the book, but he hadn't read Negative Dialectics. And when I told him, because he's heard nothing but Lewis and Joyce from me, when I told him that Ben begins with Lewis and Joyce, he was in absolute shock. He said, "What do you mean? I mean, nobody knows about that, Bob." I said, "Well, Ben does."
Yeah. Well, absolutely, but on the other hand, it's a bit obvious, isn't it? I mean, what did Frank Zappa keep doing? What he kept doing is releasing pop records, which were marketed in a pop circumstance, and he always had a quote from some weird guy called Edgard Varèse saying the present-day composer refuses to die. Now, if you're interested in what Zappa did, it seemed to me a bit obvious to say, well, who is this guy, and where's he come from, and what went on? And if you pursue Edgar Varèse, you want to find out his problems with getting his music played, you it's an entree, it's an entry, it's an entry point into the 1920s, the 1930s, all the divisions that were happening, breaking up, opening up European culture. That's exactly where Varese was. So for me, and the other thing is Zappa's immediate understanding of Dada, that he immediately understood 1920s revolutionary modernism in Europe, him and Captain Beefheart. How did they find that out? It's something I'm still studying and trying to imagine, how these high school kids in California, in a completely different system, should immediately have such sympathy with a revolutionary art movement that most of the people they're at school with would never have heard of.
No, again, we're totally matching here, because that's what I've pondered for many decades, and I've occasionally brought up with Frank. And, you know, it is in the Bob Marshall interview with Zappa where I ask him about the symbolists now, and he says, I never heard of those guys. He didn't know what I was talking about.
But in the real Frank Zappa book, he says he was very enthusiastic when he discovered Dada, because he found here were people who thought just like himself. I love the way that he immediately liked them, but he wasn't going to say he learned anything from them. And there was also a nice short name for it. And so, you know, he could see the point straight away.
The question is when did he discover that? He doesn't tell us in the biography.
Mm.
I mean, that's the interesting point.
Yeah, I mean, we do know that they were both very influenced by a Dali exhibition, Salvador Dali, in L.A., which had a car in it raining from the inside. And this became the name of a song in Trapmaster Replica. So, I am aware that they were aware of Dali, you know, explicitly.
When was that exhibit? In 68?
I don't know. I haven't done the research to sort that out.
Okay, I have 2 points to make, and I'm going to eventually get to them. The first one is, it's in Newsweek in late 69. There's a review of Bat Beefheart. He is getting mainstream coverage, and they talk about, I think they title it, probably in someone's archive, some Zappologist, they title it Dada in Rock. And it has a picture of Beefheart, probably from the Trumpmaster Replica cover, and it talks about Zapp and Beefheart, but Newsweek called them Dada in Rock. I used to think later, that's where Frank found out he was Dada. Newsweek, the scholar at Newsweek named it, and Frank had to find out what the hell the reviewer was talking about.
Yeah.
Fantasy.
I think that's very likely, and some people feel that that kind of, the fact that Zappa didn't already know that is a slight on him, but for me it's completely the other way about. That I think that when artists find similar things, if they haven't heard of each other and they produce similar things, it proves the truth of the art. And this is where I get interested. And in fact, the whole method of the negative dialectics of Poodle Play, my absurd name for how I analyze culture, is in homing in on coincidences. The weird way in which different people who haven't been influenced by each other find exactly the same image to describe something. Why should this be? And for me, explaining coincidence is the beginning of understanding everything.
Exactly, and I got a lot to say about that, but I'm not going to get distracted. Just let's remember, I heard Gail Zappa on maybe WBAI a few days after Zappa died. I think it was Dave Marsh interviewing her, and she pointed out how Frank noticed the synchronicities in his life with things going out there in the world. And that is where the concept of synchrony comes in. So Frank was working with coincidence, definitely. And that's the common theme. I like what you say on the last show, March 4th, you say, if the artist doesn't deal with everything, he's not even beginning. You have to deal with everything. That's how you begin. Now, the next point, let me just go on for a minute or so. The next point is that when, of course, I supposedly talked to Frank through the medium Michael Blake Reed, when he channeled the Evergreens, and the Evergreens brought Zap in, and I spoke to Frank.
Can I just explain to anyone listening that this means Bob has spoken to Frank Zappa after he's dead? It's a conversation with the dead Frank Zappa that Bob is using a medium who's used by the Secret Service in America, and
yes.
Very expensive. You have to pay him amounts of dollars to have an audience. And what I've heard of it, he seems to do a lot of of getting the person asking the questions to really reveal everything, but it's a method of revealing things about what Frank Zappa is. And before you just decide that Bob is a lunatic for believing you can talk to somebody beyond the grave, you have to actually evaluate the insights he gains that way. And I evaluate the insights. I don't worry about is it true, is it not true. All I'm interested in is it perceptive. And I find all the things that Frank says beyond the grave to Bob very interesting and very apt. So that's why I haven't decided Bob's a lunatic and refuse to talk to him.
Yeah, great. And the so Michael Blake Reed, he'd be unconscious for an hour, and the Evergreens, I would talk to the Evergreens, and they could bring anybody in. So an entity claiming to Frank Zappa, it could be just a marvelous astral simulation. It may not have been the Frank Zappa that died. I don't know what it was, but he certainly knew, the entity certainly knew everything about Frank's life, and Nigel Lennon was very impressed when she's one of the few people's heard the audio tape of it. But anyways, Michael Blake Reed, when he comes out of trance after an hour, he gives his impressions because he's dreaming that on the topics. His brain is just reacting, you know, on the neurological level. So when we did a couple of the famous Zappa published in Flipside interviews, he came out of one session, he says, "What impresses me is how huge Frank's head is, his brain is. I was inside his head," he said. You know, he's hallucinating in his dream state while the Evergreens are using his skull to talk to me. And he said, "I was inside Frank's head. It was so huge. The guy had so much creativity. It was incredible." Now, this is a medium, a guy who doesn't know anything about Frank. Anyways, my point of bringing that in, is Frank hit the ground running at age 3 or something, and he did not have to worry about being creative. He was creative. It just poured out of him. So he didn't have to go to school. He didn't have to decide what art he was doing. He was already possessed. That's the thing about Frank. He didn't need to study anything about art. He knew he was creative, or felt it, or was confident. You get my point?
I do, but it sounds suspiciously close to what somebody, a young enthusiastic fan, said to Frank in an early interview. He said, "I think you're a genius." And Frank was very sharp with him and said, "I don't think that's a useful term." And I like your hosannas for Frank. Everybody should pay more attention to Frank.
No hosannas. I'm saying the guy had the energy of he was a psychotic. Let's call him a social. He's a social psychopath. He had to express himself like he was OCD'd up to the max.
Bob, I want to get more precise, because when you like an artist, building them up and just saying they're really special is just repeating the fact that you like them as an artist. And I want to be...
don't talk about him as... I'm talking about the energy of the guy. I spent many hours with him. I saw the energy.
This energy is actually your energy. And I just want to make a... Can I just tell you something about a German artist who did a cartoon book about his fascination with Zappa? His name is Andreas Rausch. And he did a fascinating cartoon book about Frank Zappa and all the things it makes go in his head. And one of the themes he took up is the gas mask, which Frank used to play with. And his idea of what Frank did with the gas mask was that he tore off the filter so that he could wear a gas mask which just had a tube running down it with absolutely no filtering of the air. But everything that Frank breathed through there, he understood in a new way as coming through the gas mask. And what this meant is, you see, this is why I'm trying to explain how huge Frank's head would appear to a medium who's accessing what Frank's brain was, that Frank found a very special doorway into the contingent or the accidental or the things that are around you that allowed his art not to have a division between the real world and his art. And the only other artist I know who managed that is James Joyce. In the use, being able to create a relationship with external reality so that the obsessed enthusiast for your art cannot anymore tell the difference between where the art stops and reality begins. And of course, this is what gives the idea of the infinity of the art. And it's really the fact that they've given you a way of looking at reality so that reality starts to be looked at in terms of how the artist spoke. And so obviously it's infinite.
Yes, and you've gone nicely into a point that I've been waiting to tell you for 5 minutes, is that people, if they don't know about Wyndham Lewis and James Joyce, You just look at a picture of Wyndham Lewis, and you will notice he's a spitting image of Captain Beefheart. That's point number one, which is eerie. And then if you look at Frank's thin face, he doesn't look like James Joyce, but he gives off the same vibe. There's something about Frank is to Joyce as Beefheart is to Wyndham Lewis. And we know there was this ongoing competition and collaboration between Beefheart and Zappa, and they replayed somehow. They picked up the meme that was going on between Joyce and Lewis.
You're talking about the twins, the oppositions of really great friendships or really great creative partnerships. And it's something I when I first freaked out from being a student, became a punk rocker and decided to do abstract collages all over my flat that I tried to work on. And what I thought was the opposition between the methods of John Coltrane and Ornette Coleman are the same as Lewis versus Joyce. It's the same as Beefheart versus Zappa. It's the same as Theodore Adorno versus Walter Benjamin. That all the people I really love have an opposite who I love almost as much, and they kind of revolve around each other like a star around a negative star, so everything flashes.
Excellent. And I think Joyce was onto that with his twins' analogical mirror in Finnegan's Wake. He understood that. He knew that he and Lewis were twins, but they're mirrors. They flip, they reverse on each other. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like looking at your mirror image.
Yeah. And I think that finding that in other people is what allows you to create infinity in your art, because you realize that it's not simply a personal pursuit of your will to power, that the way people understand art in this society is modeled on how people behave in this society. And in this society, the idea of competition and the will to power is the dominant model. That's what everybody's about. Now, this, the thing we're talking about for me is a vision of a different way of organizing everything, which has in it an understanding of what your relationship to your opposite is. And so it's proper dialectics.
Yeah, that's good. I think I had a list a few years ago, a picture from some article, and it laid out the twins all through art history. I don't know, David versus somebody, Raphael versus somebody. You know, it was pretty interesting. And McLuhan sees that media environments mime that. So he would analyze Watergate as a battle between television and the newspaper for the advertising dollar. And he saw media environments as people. And he thinks that that's what Joyce was doing. And he can find quotes in Finnegan's Wake showing that. Now, how does that insight, whether it's real or not, how does that relate to our revolution? Because you said we want to reorient things, reorient the social organization, but technologies and Skype are doing it for us. So where does the human body input? What are we looking for? I mean, I'm quite happy with everything, but you know, if I turn on the TV, I could be depressed at some particular content. But they just emphasize bad news so they can sell the good news. What's the good news? The ads, and the ads upset people. So because nobody wants to realize they don't have something, and therefore it flips into the bad news is good news in its effect because people feel they're surviving everything. So there's a dialectic right there between good news and bad news, or what's the good revolution, what's the bad revolution? Technology obviously is revolution. Marx knew that, and Joyce and McLuhan refined it. And how do we apply that to our revolution, and what revolution are Jim and I doing? That brings in, you and I are twins in a lot of ways. I mean, when I read your book, I said, geez, this guy is thinking the same stuff I do. Where did he come from? You know, and then I decided you were a collective. That's what I write in Up the Orphanity, the Ben Watson Collective, because I saw you quoted from all these other Zappa heads, and you were just like the talking head on the news show. You just get, you know, the PR person for a collective.
And when you said that, I remember thinking, oh, if only. And but it stimulated me to try and make that happen, which is this connection between people I call the esemplasm. The idea of bringing everything into one, and that's what I've been pursuing, stimulated by your fantasy that I was a collective. I'm trying to make that true, because simply pursuing one's own ideas versus everybody else is limited and boring, and not this idea of infinity that we've established exists in Zappa's head, and I've asserted James Joyce can do as well, should be available for absolutely everybody. And I think that infinity is the revolution we're talking about.
That's right. That's a good point. We're trying, the anybody who joins in and hears this, that we're not trying to beat them over with a concept. What we're talking about, they can understand if we find out what their terms of reference are and then adapt it to what we're saying. Oh. We're actually trying to match. We're just trying to say, look, there's... Don't worry that you didn't make it to university, or everybody on your union hates you, or you're a corporate executive in jail like Madoff will be. Don't worry about that. We understand why you got there. But what try to understand what we can know now. Something like that. That's something like that is what motivates me.
So you're looking for sympathetic souls wherever they come from and why ever.
No. Yeah, I would say not personally, but in understanding what we should do as a collective, what they call politics, if we define the question properly, then maybe we'd stop wasting our energies, which is what you complain about in your writing. These pomo critics and cultural czars, they waste their energies, and they waste everybody else's energies because they don't know the question.
Yeah.
And so I am trying to find the question, and maybe you can't even say it verbally, but I seem to, in your show, you present a question. You have a young brain, Iris, on there, being molded by the environment. And then you have your preferences and whether you should impose them on her. And she resists anyways. It sounds like impossible. Iris is never going to take anything from you. But she is learning how to be a DJ. But the thing is, then you do Prince poetry, and then you cancel out with some ridiculous R&B, and then you play classical serial music. This is appropriate. You are a quadraphenic, Ben, which is schizophrenia squared.
And all it is, really, is Frank Zappa in practice. You'll find, if you can find radio shows by Michael H. Tenser, you'll find an extremely similar procedure. Michael H. Tenser first got in touch with me by sending me his radio shows. He called it Ear Liberation Front, and they were on college radio in New York. And maybe it was a bit cooler and less chaotic than the shows that I end up with. I don't really like the chaos. It's more product of lack of time and problems I'm having, although I sort of try and ride it. They were quite cool, but what he was interested in was segues. His whole point was that real music listening has to set something up and then change it. So that the whole idea of the iPod, of downloading the specific track and not being interested in the context in which it is, or not knowing the context in which it is an atomization which is destroying proper listening. And so what he would do is simply set up listening to a long stretch of, it could be Brahms, and suddenly throwing you into some pygmies chanting, whatever it was. But his idea of segues was learnt from Frank Zappa. My idea of segues is totally learnt from Frank Zappa. And I realised that with Frank Zappa, people who try and make him out to be a great composer always miss the point. Because the great thing about him is editing. The great thing about him is on the medium of tape, you can stop one thing and start another. And that if you just say, oh, he's a writer of great songs, I love this song works, and you try and cut it out of its context, I think you miss the whole argument, and you can't learn from it. You can try and write songs like that, you'll never get anywhere. Whereas if you learn from the editing, I think that you can emulate that in other fields. And I'd say Matt Groening and The Simpsons is a perfect example of something that's learned from the editing point of view, from the segues, from the shocks, from the surprises, from the changes, and able to suddenly produce something which has done, I think, probably the only mass media entity over the last 10 years, which I enjoy, you know, from a purely personal point of view, but I think you could make all sorts of arguments for it having a good effect in other ways.
Yes, I disagree in this way. McLuhan pointed out that to do art today in the 20th century, you have to do collage. And he wasn't pro-collage. He was explaining why people felt that was the only way to do it. And then he pointed out, okay, then you're not going to appreciate Beethoven. But you need to know why Beethoven was linear and not collage, unless some musical scholar proved me different. But anyways, the very lack of ability to appreciate Beethoven or Francesco Zappa is the thing that partly is what I'm doing in the revolution. You do not want to be embedded in your time. And so when Bob Marshall, using my questions, interviewed Zappa, we were trying to get Frank to wake up. Now, we enjoyed Frank, me and Bob Marshall, for the music he did. His concert was the best thing, better than UFO showing up. But in terms of how it relates to social reality, it wasn't relevant. And so the very thing, so your mania as a punk getting into collage and assemblage is the very thing that led to your psychosis in the early 80s. And you did not know why you were identifying with that. So I haven't heard Tenzer's show, but it's not relevant to understanding our time. You have to know why people think assemblage and editing and collage and quadrophenia is attractive and resonant. Usually it's because the establishment, which is 200 years behind everybody, representing the slime in your TV, it's been holding you in prison for 300 years, that slime is ancient, and it is linear, because it's there are a bunch of chartered accountants, and they're doing bookkeeping. And if you react to that, you're not getting anywhere. So I am actually trying to get everybody back to being linear and understanding the basics. That's why McLuhan called his work a science. Now, I'm not doing that in the normal way. I'm not, a college professor or even the head of the CIA and demanding people to get in order and get in line, right? I'm not talking about that. But that is my response to your celebration. You one point, Ben, maybe too early to say it, you said to me, I hate Frank Zappa. And I turned around and I shook your hand. I said, good, now we're getting somewheres. Okay? And we never got past that point of recognition. But the thing is that Frank didn't get it. He didn't understand the present, even though he was the best expression of the present. And then the argument is, well, the artist can't understand the present. And thank Bob that they doesn't understand it. If you understood it, you wouldn't produce anything. So respond, please, Ben, to my little rant there. I'm glad you let me go on.
Well, you did complain off recording a couple of weeks ago that I didn't ever let you finish, so I was really trying to let you finish there. I really enjoyed your impassioned polemic there against what I'd call postmodern collage and the idea that if you mix everything up and make it all bit of this and bit of that, you're somehow ultra-modern, and the idea that the fragmentary is in itself revolutionary, and that the breaking linear logic is the if you can be non-linear, you're immediately with the angels and with the new sexuality and so on. I love what you were saying, but the particular object that we're talking about, unfortunately, is not a common object between us, so I need to explain a bit more about why I like Michael's shows. He wasn't doing the usual cut up at random mess up at all. He was drawing attention to what the inner construction of each of the pieces were by carefully arranging one piece after another. He didn't break the integrity of any of the pieces. He was always showing you how you were listening by preventing you going, oh, I'm in a jazz show, or I'm in a classical music show, I'm in a pop show, I know where I am. Yes, he stopped that. He was against the fetishism of musical genres, which prevents people actually alerting their ears. But he had complete interest and respect for the internal construction of each piece, which he showed by his segues. So it's not really collage he was doing, it was segues. And one thing following another like a logical argument. And in that, in this recontextualization that he's doing, is I think part of what we're trying to do, which is putting things in a context in which people can understand it, rather than just the blib blab squib sclab, isn't this exciting, I've mucked everything up, which I think rightly objecting to.
I understand exactly what you're saying. And so what comes to mind is that McLuhan, in his figure, in his understanding of the content and why the medium, the form, made the content popular and responsible, or ability to respond to it, he borrowed from Gestalt therapy, the original Gestalt therapy, the terms figure and ground. And so ground is context. Figure is the content. If we're celebrating Michael Tenzer for doing that, then kudos to him.
And that's very like Frank. That's very like Frank, who explained that harmonic, if you play something on guitar, it only means something against a harmonic environment. He talked about that in trying to explain his guitar work. And I remember reading that and thinking, is this conservative? Is he saying that we have to have a context in which things work? But when I really thought about it, I thought, well, people who try and play guitar out of any context at all, what are they trying to do? Where are they? And I came round to agreeing with this figure and ground thing from Gestalt therapy, which Marshall McLuhan talked about.
Yes, and that's why on my chart I put Zappa and McLuhan together, because I would read the very thing you're quoting. I would read that and say, well, that's McLuhan's Figure Ground. It's young mind, Frank Zappa. He's born 30 years after Zappa, after McLuhan. And for some reason, he caught up. And then he just expressed it in popular music and became really well known, probably more well known for young kids than McLuhan. But he was making the same point. He didn't get it as high level. As Jerry Fialka said when he read Mechanical Bride, he said, this is, Zappa's nowhere near this depth. And I would agree with that. But it's not a depth in the, I don't know, in the old fashioned sense. I want to add, now the other point is that Zappa in 69, and this is our archival selves, I like to tweak your archival self by saying things like that. I think it's Circus Magazine, 1969. He does free association in this article, and someone says the word Gestalt to him, and he goes, something big, which is interesting. It's not really the right answer in terms of Gestalt Figure Ground, but what is something big? And then when you think of the big note, it seemed to me that Frank, when he interpreted the word Gestalt as something big, was what McLuhan did, presented a big thing, get you out of your context, get the consumer out of their identified category, what they think they're listening to or themselves. And so,
which
that's
means,
a
of course, which,
that's
could
a
I gloss that?
Effort.
When you say get the consumer out of something, can I gloss that saying out of money?
That's true. That's part of it. We're only in it for the money. Yeah. You know, Frank admitted that. But the thing is that...
I think he accused that. I think he meant that as an accusation against the Beatles. I don't think he was proposing that as something about his own band or every band or anything like that.
Yeah, you're right, but he also he had that included. If he was accused of being too commercial, he said, well, I admitted it. You know, he had that as a backup.
Now, Bob, there's something unfinished in my brain about Figure Ground. And, you see, I like it when you're saying Frank Zappa doesn't go far enough. We can get round him. Part of what we're doing is being able to see beyond him. And I think that when you reach the hardcore Frank Zappa fans, the ones who want to finish with Zappa, I want to pile on more dialectics. Well, what do I mean by that? What I mean is taking something like saying you can only play a guitar solo within a known harmonic environment. If you started proposing that as a rule, it seems to me it would be very unrealistic about the music that we actually like, and that we can extend our conversations. Dialectics isn't about some system in the sky. It's about paying more attention to what actually goes on. And so if you listen to some of the great pieces of guitar playing that you've ever heard, if you listen, you'll find that the figure is changing the ground, that the energies that the guitar player is putting in is causing the bass player and the drummer to alter what they're doing. They don't simply keep on hammering the stuff like they're not hearing what the guitar player's doing. So that figure and ground actually have a dialectical relationship, and they're not set apart. Or rather, the terms for them are like time and space, but if we have an Einsteinian understanding of relativity in terms of figure ground, we discover that they influence each other and that the whole thing becomes bendy, and we realise that actually one thing seems to be the opposite and turns around, curls around and becomes the other. And so figure ground are useful for starting, for distinguishing things, and maybe Frank was at that point when he said that, but when you actually understand a piece of exciting guitar playing, you've got to understand how the ground is being affected and totally changed and becomes sometimes the figure itself.
Exactly. I think of McLuhan when he did a book called From Cliché to Archetype, and then he says in another book, he goes, well, you go from cliché to archetype or in reverse. And that's exactly what you learn from Finnegan's Wake. You learn that from Zappa. You learn the dialectical thing. And figure ground, it's literate minds that began to see perspective, according to McLuhan's theory, that print enhanced the eye and the vanishing point. To see figure ground is basically a literate bias, but the acoustic and tactile media make us realize that figure ground is not a figure in a context. It is a fluid, liquid, dialectical something, interplay or tactility. That is what we mean by figure ground. It's not the literate version of there's this and it fits over here, everything proper in its right place. That's not what. In other words, I'm saying the same thing you just said in my terms, right?
This is the idea of our conversations. And I would go back to the Cambridge thing. The key for me of actually using what I'd learned at Cambridge rather than repeating it was my friend Danny Houston, who was older than me and had been a hippie and had never managed to crack university, who got me to shout on the street, "All students are cunts," using a word which was absolutely forbidden at the time when he said it, because he'd had a bad time trying to do a bit of further education. He hadn't been good at it. And Danny educated me in a completely different way, but I knew he was worth talking to and intelligent, because whenever I played a record to him, he'd make a comment that actually heard the music, and I found all these over-educated shitheads that I was students with couldn't hear anything. They put on records and they make comments, they'd sort of tell you about the biography of the composer or something they knew. They couldn't listen. And so what interests me about this, we agree on these kind of non-intellectual, non-educated people who are so perceptive musically that there must be a way of talking about what their intelligence is. Now, some people call it technological. These people are used to dealing with mass media and records and record covers or something like that. Or you can use the term musical. And I noticed that when you were being extremely nice and flattering about the radio shows that I do, which are called Late Lunch with Out to Lunch, and you can find them at archive.org if you wish. When you were being nice about them, you talked about me and my musical understanding rather than, say, my understanding of media. So where do you put this in these people who aren't university educated but have incredible perceptions, and where you feel sympathy with what they're, relief of what they're saying in comparison with your over-educated shithead pseudo-friends that you've had before? And I think we've had that common experience with people. But how do you choose your language? Why do you call it musical sometimes and call it, well, aware of the eye and technology rather than, you know, the roundabout that way?
Because I consider all technologies coming from the word techne, which was back then, 2,500 years ago, referred to art or whatever humans made. So I can put, I'm like Finnegan's Wake, technology means music, means painting, means tongues, means cunts, it means anything. So that's the fluidity of language.
But it tends to mean that techne means a rather lower class nuts and bolts attitude rather than the high class conceptual attitude. I mean, is that a difference you acknowledge?
Yes, as McLuhan said, that he said this back in the 50s, that children of North America find poetry in trains and automobiles and airplanes because that's what they grow up with. Whereas kids in Europe, this is, you know, older Europe, they found poetry in books and old fine art stuff. They didn't have as much technological industrial stuff. Oh. So there was a basic difference. And I found McLuhan's statement that European artists, and that would include British, they translate technology into verbal art. Yeah. Whereas the North Americans turn verbal art into technological art.
But don't you think there's a certain kind of cheap futurism? He's echoing back Marinetti's thing, you know, you're in Italy, you're in a backward country, you're cluttered up with the old classical culture, so you suddenly announce to everybody, actually, you know, a racing car is more beautiful than some classical sculpture whose name I can't remember. That gambit is kind of, for me, it's odd, because the European artists who like a particular painting or a book don't like... Listen. They don't like paintings and books in general. There's a particular book or painting which twinges them. And I don't see how a car can twinge you in that way. Maybe a R&B record, you know, that might exist in the mass market. But it's got to be a specific expression. So just saying, well, or in front of cars and planes can replace people's attachment to a book or a book or a statue seems to me to be mixing how these things really work. It seems to me quite kind of stupid.
Okay, look, again, you didn't even know what I was talking about. McLuhan did not praise Europeans or North American. He was saying kids who grow up in North America find poetry in the environment they're in. And the Europeans find something different. Now, McLuhan spent his life beating verbal culture like Finnegan's Wake and Wyndham Lewis over the heads of the technological conditioned kids in North America. And he didn't even support Finnegan's Wake. Like, he wasn't saying European was better. He was just saying, hey, kids, you need to know more than your immediate environment.
So Bob, that's European- not what... Bob, that's not what I'm objecting to. I'm not objecting to better or worse. I'm objecting to the comparison. The correct comparison to cars and aeroplanes has to be cart horses and boats or something. It has to be means of transport. The correct comparison to books and paintings has to be what art you have around you, which is television and records. There's somehow it's a mixed, it's jumping from one to the other in a way that I find offensive to my sense of basic logic.
This could be your conditioning from Cambridge. This is the handicap you're operating under, Ben. I mean, we are talking about jumping around. That's what Zappa is. Now,
could you give me a concrete example of an American kid who found poetry in an aeroplane? Somebody we've heard of or anything, you know?
Oh, well, you know that American kids, you know, I don't know if they do it now. I haven't seen a kid in decades, but the... I did see Iris, though. But I had to go to Europe to see a baby. Okay. Anyways, the...
Well, that's because you're in Hawaii, where everybody's there to die, aren't they? I mean, it's a retirement place.
That's right. No, not in the beaches.
Apart from you, who are going to live forever, you know, but all the rest of them.
But, yeah, they're all dying around me. But the way kids in America in the 50s and 60s, they would have little train sets. You know what I mean? They play with trains. Did they have train sets in Europe, or did they have little tin soldiers? Didn't you have little tin soldiers?
Yeah, we had tin soldiers, but now at least you're comparing like with like, and I know where I am.
Oh, okay. I never know what you're going to agree with. There is a huge abyss between us, Ben, even though we're exactly alike. But let's keep working on this.
Let's work on it.
I think that the McLuhan meant that the kids like train sets and tinkering with their cars. Did Derek Bailey tinker with a car? No, he didn't have anything. Right?
Well, as usual, as a North American setting up America versus Europe, you're ignoring class, you know, because Derek's...
Oh, I can bring class in. That's another issue, but it does relate.
But
I'll bring in class.
You see, that's the yawning gulf which separates Derek from culture as we know it, which is he grew up with the idea that he had to go work down the mines or go up telegraph poles, and he hated that idea. And for him, American film completely opened up his mind because, and this is a kid who's he's a child during the Second World War, and the American troops are here. This is all very exciting for people because they're also well fed. I mean, when he first went to play guitar in France at an American army camp, he couldn't believe the alcoholism of the soldiers when they came back from prancing over fields, and he had to play country music to them, how grotesque it all was. But he couldn't believe the size of the club sandwich. This was unbelievable for a little kid from Sheffield, the kind of food that English people had. And when he saw American films and they had the idea that maybe you could be an insurance salesman, he said to me, that's a complete revelation. I never knew anyone could be an insurance salesman. This is a different world. And
now that's the advantage, that's McLuhan's point. The global culture, which Joyce and Lewis were talking about, and maybe Pound and Eliot, and not so much Yeats.
I don't think so, you see.
The global culture. Derek Bradley was not British. He was getting and seeing movies like everybody else in the West.
Yeah, I've got to blow a whistle on you, though, because, you see, the difference is that Lewis and Joyce did talk about the mass media, whereas classically American upper class, Pound and Eliot spent their whole time trying to imbibe European culture, in inverted commas, which means they only really accepted as experience the statues and the books and all the rest of it, and they didn't take seriously what ordinary people are experiencing. That was low to them. It was everything they were running away from, which is why, for me, the art they produce is a feat and an echo of an attempt to be art, which merely repeats art and has no, that doesn't get its fingernails dirty, can't really deal with the world.
Yeah, I don't know if I would totally agree with you, but I can understand on the surface what you're saying. And yes, the Pound and Eliot were failed vortices. Joyce was a supreme vorticist, like Lewis. And Zappa was a vorticist, so was Beefheart. They were vortices, which nobody knows about. You know, I went to the conference when I was there with you in April last year at some museum.
That's called Senate House. Senate House.
Some puny museum.
That was Senate House, and there's a lot of argument about Senate House at the moment, Bob, because it was the It used to be where George Orwell worked. It's in fact the Ministry of Fear from 1984, that building. And it's a common rooms for the use of London University, but it's going to be, they want to close it down. So there's quite a battle over Senate House. Now, isn't this amazing, everybody? Here we're having real literary discussion on the radio.
I'm not talking about Senate. Let me dominate here. I'm not talking about Senate House. That's the Finney's Waking. I'm talking about the fucking conference. Oh, sorry. I'm talking about the, delete that. I'm talking about the conference I went to with Alan. What's his name? You know, the Beefheart scholar, the Wyndham Lewis scholar.
Oh, right, Alan. Yeah.
What was his name?
Alan. Munton.
And that the Museum of Modern Art or something there you have, that big thing. I was joking saying it was a little place. It was a huge museum.
What, but they were trying... Tate Modern in the old powerhouse. With the chimneys.
I think it was the Tate Modern or not. It was the other Tate.
British Tate, which has all the... which has all the William Blake and stuff in it.
Yeah, the Camden Town exhibit is what I went to. Camden Town, I don't know which one. It wasn't the one with the amazing lookout building. You know, you go up on the roof.
So, Bob, can you please explain to the listeners why they are listening to your account of your brief brush with British art?
That they had to explain vorticism. It's been suppressed. The best that came out of British culture, Joyce and Lewis. And Lewis, for those who don't know, you could have gone and seen his portraits last summer. And Lewis is just arriving. You know what I mean? The National Portrait Gallery there in London had a held over exhibit of Lewis's paintings. It was a big celebration. So now he's known finally, at least to somebody. And that the vorticists are a suppressed art movement.
Absolutely, and this is what brings us back to our enthusiasm for Zappa and Beefheart, for drawing this line of artistic animosity to society as it exists out again, and this rebirth of this violent attack by the artists on the society as we know it. And my argument is that art is only worth its salt if it's that extreme and attacks society that much, whereas most art isn't art at all. It's something that wants to lubricate the goings of the normal society. And this complete opposition of art to society is something that was reborn with Zappa and Beefheart. We can talk to each other because we understand this historical nature of this battle.
Right, and Figure Ground comes in here. Zappa's art was that orientation, but the personality, the sober rationalist who wanted to run for president, was Frank Zappa in another context. He knew different Figure Ground relationships. He was different in different contexts.
Completely, and one reason that I have a continuing warfare with the so-called hardcore Zappa fans is that they elide those two and can't see any difference between the man and the art. Whereas if you make that difference, then you become someone yourself, because you are able to interpret the art in advance of what Frank himself thought about it.
Right, and I tell you, someday Gail's going to listen to this, and she's going to realize that there's finally someone intelligently talking about her husband's work, because she tries to express this view of Frank when she's interviewed, like the recent CBC documentary on Frank. She feels alienated from everybody because they don't know the other Frank, and she keeps doing that. She should be amazed that there are two Zappa fanatics who understand what she experienced.
Well, we should all be amazed.
Yeah, so what do you mean? I'm not amazed.
Well, we've only got 3 minutes now to wrap up this particular...
What do you mean? We should be amazed at what? What are we being amazed? I didn't get the context.
Well, I believe in this is a point that Walter Benjamin made when he was reading The Surrealists, which is that the actual facts of being a sentient being derived from what we're derived of, from the amoeba right through the whole of evolution, the fact that our hands can grasp things is completely weird and extraordinary. And those weird surrealist paintings that make your hand look funny are actually the truth about your hand, and that amazement should be the permanent state we're in, and that there's some kind of awful oppression we're under which suppresses this amazement and reduces it just to the tiny times when you can go and shout at Michael Jackson in the O2 Arena, or, you know, these little moments, because, of course, they can make some money out of it. And part of the revolution of what I want to do is to live in a state of perpetual amazement, because it is really weird where we are and what we're doing.
Yes, in November 1970, approximately, in New York Times, Frank is quoted to the New York Times journalist. He says, "It's basically very weird being alive." And that's the core of the difference between being a vortex or not. You have to have that sensibility, that intuition that's weird being alive. Everybody has it, but they forget it, or they forgot the context of how to exploit it. I thought you meant that it was amazing that Gail might listen to us. I don't know. I thought you were addressing Gail, but you didn't mean that. Okay, good. Here's the thing. It is also not weird to be alive. You can actually understand what it is. So again, the ambivalence, the ambiguity, the tactile systole diastole of the dialectic is what's always happening in our doubleness.
Because
that's why we're twins.
Because weirdness is the beginning of understanding. Unless it's weird, you're not going to think about it. But thinking about it may render it something else, but probably even more weird.
That's a good point. Very good point.
I'm the timekeeper here because I'm the person behaving as recording engineer onto Audio Hijack Pro, which is a mechanism, a cheap thing you can download, which records your stuff, which I'd recommend to everyone. And this is the end of the fourth conversation between Bob Dobbs and Ben Watson, and it was held on the 11th of March 2009, and this was number 4. See you again next week, Bob.
Okay, Ben.